Wonderful people, and especially prayer is, really actually works. It asks somebody to pray, and they pray, and it makes a real difference, absolutely. Now, I'm actually supposed to be in good health. My doctor says I am. And, I have a new PBC doctor, by the way. I don't know if any of you have met Dr. Madoff, who goes here. Wonderful doctor in Portola Valley, and he's sort of managing everything, no nonsense, careful. All I have is arthritis, just simple, plain, old rheumatism for 20 years. And for long years, the arthritis pain was manageable with conventional drugs. And a lot of you probably have arthritis, and it's manageable by conventional drugs. But I got to a place where I couldn't take the usual conventional nice drugs anymore. I had to switch to opiates. I'm actually, you're talking to an addict here today. And that worked for a while, but the trouble with opiates is they work less well the longer you use them, and you have to take more and more, and pretty soon you take too much. the Stanford Pain Clinic has a wonderful new program for moving people off of drugs like opiates onto other more friendly medicines. And that's where I'm at right now. I'm in the transition of moving over into a new drug. So this means I'm loaded with twice as much chemicals as usual. So if I become incoherent, or I begin to read the wrong chapter, or I don't know why, the main thing I run out of is energy. It's not that I'm running around in pain all day. It's that I just find that an extra nap is nice. the other thing I have to say is I have learned more about the Lord in the last couple of years than in the previous 40 years. The things that you only learn when you get a little bit of rough going spiritually. And the flood of information that I hadn't realized was all true about me is flooding in. And it's very healthy. It's a tremendous time to learn. And I have a new appreciation of my own wretchedness as a rotten sinner, number one, but I also can see the state of the world a little bit better, I think, and that's not cool. So I have two concerns. One would be my own walk with God, and the other would be the low state of the church in general. And the solution to this, I think, is going to be grassroots prayer. It's getting God's people together to pray, not in a necessarily in a formal way, but just to begin to pray. So that's what all my newsletters have been leading up to. And I think next time I'll write a letter suggesting how we might begin to pray intelligently for the times in which we live in a regular way. And I'm suggesting that all Christians pray in a new unstructured way. That's my solution to the world's problems. And the Lord's coming in any case, and probably not too long from now. Today I arbitrarily picked Psalm 18 because I like Psalm 18, and I hope you like it too. And I don't want to read Isaiah 18, however. Found the right chapter number, but it said it talked about Ethiopia. I have a hard time getting that one twisted around into. David wrote this psalm probably towards the end of his life. It's probably a summary. The reason we suspect that is that it is included in its entirety right at the close of 2 Samuel 22. You'll find it printed there. And right after that, the last words of David and a few closing remarks. Because this psalm gives a summary of his life. Many of the other psalms of David talk about individual situations where he was in trouble and he cried out to God and God's had help come right away. But this is not that kind of a psalm of help me, Lord, I'm in trouble and God rescues him. This is a kind of an interesting overview of his whole life. David was one of how many kids? He had seven brothers and a sister. And where did he come down in the order of firstborn? No, he's number eight. And he was very popular with his older brothers. No, how come? His mother was a Moabitess. He had red hair. He was ruddy. He had light skin and red hair, and he probably looked different than his brothers. And I believe he also had a sister by the same mother. And he got teased and picked on and had a rough life and ended up just being the guy that goes and takes care of the sheep. All of his other brothers were sure they were much more qualified to be the king, but God picked him. And you know a lot, I'm sure, about the life of David, but the Psalms are magnificent records of his life. This one has a long title on it, To the Choir Master, a Psalm of David, the servant of the Lord, who addressed the words of this song to the Lord on the day when the Lord delivered him from the hand of all of his enemies and from the hand of Saul. He's reviewing his whole life, and he goes back to remember that when it started, Saul was trying to kill him because David was the legitimate king and Saul had been disqualified. And he had a very rough dozen years at the beginning of his life, and he's looking back. And here's what he says. I love thee, O Lord, my strength. The Lord is my rock and my fortress and my deliverer. Those three strong words about strength and refuge and safety. He calls God my rock, in whom I take refuge, my shield, the horn of my salvation, my stronghold. All those references to strength and power and safety and solid fortresses surrounding him to shield him from any danger. And the Lord is that kind of ultimate, infinite, strong resource. My shield, the horn of my salvation, my stronghold. Do anybody know what the symbol of a horn is about? The horn of my salvation. It's not totally certain. Well, it's one of the symbols for strength. The horn of a male ram or a male goat is a picture of its virility and its strength. I call upon the Lord, who is worthy to be praised, and I am saved from my enemies. There is a song about, isn't there a chorus? I think there is a chorus that uses those words. Now, in the next chapters, we're going to talk about things that we may have trouble finding, identifying as having happened to David. He says in verse 4, the cords of death encompassed me, the torrents of perdition assailed me, the cords of Sheol entangled me, the snares of death confronted me. Now, those are as poetic imagery, of course, and it's vivid poetry, as you can see. He is looking back on a situation where he was in peril of his life and in great danger and no hope of being rescued, as if he was being swallowed up by Sheol, by the grave. And he says, in my distress I called upon the Lord. To my God I cried for help. From his temple he heard my voice, and my cry to him reached his ears. Where was the temple? Hadn't been built yet, the one in Jerusalem. That was built by his son Solomon. So this is the heavenly temple. This is the temple that God showed to Moses and said, build the tabernacle after this model. So this is, look at the imagery here of David being down on the depths of the earth someplace in some underground cavern, swallowed up by floods of water and great peril, and he cries out, and where does God come from to help? Comes from the highest heaven, comes right out of the temple in heaven and sends help from the highest place and gives personal attention to David's needs, as if David was the only person in the whole world that had any needs at the time. And guess what happens as God begins to act? In my distress, I called upon the Lord. To my God, I cried for help. From his temple, he heard my voice, and my cry to him reached his ears. And what happens next? Then the earth reeled and rocked. The foundations also of the mountains trembled and quaked because he was angry. Who's he angry at? He's angry at the forces that have come against his servant David. Not angry at David. but shakes the whole earth to the foundation. Can you pray like that? If you have a hard time, can you pray and we have a nice big earthquake? Well, I'm not recommending that necessarily, but the idea here is that God acts swiftly. Smoke went up from his nostrils and devouring fire from his mouth. Glowing coals flamed forth from him. As if God was a great dragon, but obviously this is not a negative picture of a dragon, it's positive imagery. He bowed the heavens and came down. Thick darkness was under his feet. He rode on a cherub and flew. He came swiftly upon the wings of the wind. He made darkness his covering around him. His canopy, thick clouds, dark with water. Out of the brightness before him, there broke through his clouds hailstones and coals of fire. The Lord also thundered in the heavens, and the Most High uttered his voice, hailstones and coals of fire. He sent out his arrows and scattered them. He flashed forth lightnings and routed them. Then the channels of the sea were seen, and the foundations of the world were laid bare at thy rebuke, O Lord, at the blast of the breath of thy nostrils. Now, what incidents or events in the history of Israel does that suggest to you, if any?
In Exodus, when God is in Mount Sinai, there's this thick cloud of thunder, and the people are afraid, and Moses goes up. It's that same imagery. He's almost like he's retelling that. Listen, people, it's that same imagery that happened when Moses went to the mountain.
Exactly. That's exactly where this comes from. And so David is borrowing on the history of his forefathers and their time at Mount Sinai. This being well known to the Jews as events in their history. When God visited Mount Sinai, there was a great earthquake, and it was terrifying, and pillars of fire came down, and the great earthquake was there. So that's the imagery in the very back.
Isaiah 64:1. Oh, that you would rend the heavens and come down, that the mountains would tremble before you. And it seems to me that that's also what, you know, resurrection, when the curtains of the temple poured to, that's God coming down, that's the answer to Isaiah's.
Yeah. Don't we all long for God to step right into history in a visible way, in a powerful way that leaves no doubt at all about who he is and who's in charge? Yeah, well, yeah, surely we do. Dramatic. This sounds like God acting directly as opposed to through the ministry of angels, but there are certainly angels in all of this big army. In verse 6, David says, in my distress I called upon the Lord. To my God I cried for help. From his temple he heard my voice. Where did I stop?
15,
okay. The channels of the sea were seen, and the foundations of the world were laid bare. At thy rebuke, O Lord, at the blast of the breath of thy nostrils. God can speak to nature, as Jesus did in calming the Sea of Galilee. Forces of nature respond immediately when God speaks to nature. God speaks to Adam, and he doesn't get that kind of response. But God spoke to the bare vacuum of space, and the universe sprang into being immediately. But human beings don't respond to God quite as easily. And what does God do? He reached from on high. He took me. He drew me out of many waters. He delivered me from my strong enemy and from those who hated me. They were too mighty for me. That's a wonderful picture here of a father coming down to rescue his little boy who's maybe having some nightmares, or one of his people who's in a serious situation, surrounded by enemies and in danger of his life. That beautiful imagery to give you reassurance about God's personal tender care for you, the creator of the universe. He delivered me from my strong enemy, from those who hated me. They were too mighty for me. They came upon me in the day of my calamity, but the Lord was my stay. He brought me forth into a broad place. He delivered me because he delighted in me. That verse there has always been one of my favorites. He took me into a broad place, into a big green meadow. Maybe you've had some months or even years of being hemmed in by life and by circumstances you couldn't get out of and by situations that were beyond your control. And then God delivers you and puts you out into a place of calm and tranquility and safety and security, a broad place, big, nice green meadow. And that's what's happened to David here. The Lord rewarded me according to my righteousness. According to the cleanness of my hands, he recompensed me. For I have kept the ways of the Lord and have not wickedly departed from my God. For all his ordinances were before me, and his statutes I did not put away from me. I was blameless before him, and I kept myself from guilt. Therefore the Lord has recompensed me according to my righteousness, according to the cleanness of my hands in his sight. Is there a problem there with the real David and the real history of his life, especially looking from over the whole? Any problem?
Yeah.
Yes, there is. Yes, let's have some comments.
Well, I would say he understands the promise of his seed that will come that will actually fulfill this. I'm thinking that Jesus could read this, and because again, he is the one that will ultimately fulfill this, and
yep.
David is just a type of him.
Yeah.
And so I trust David looks forward.
That would be, there's one good solution to this problem, that this is, he's looking to the Messiah as the one who is able to fulfill what this verse asks of us. What else do you see here?
I think as last week we talked about in Psalm 32, David recognized his sin, but God forgave, and he was happy, he was blessed, and I see more of this is, yeah, I understand what happened, but now God has saved me, he's pulled me back, and I'm clothed in his righteousness right now. It's not a self-righteousness. He's recognizing, it's almost like he's reflecting. This is written later. Psalm 32 was written earlier when he saw his sin and he was forgiven.
When you have really sought the Lord for forgiveness of your sin and really had God deal with it, it's gone. It's gone forever and can't be brought up against you, and the case is closed. And you don't have to remind yourself ever again. A lot of people, as you learned last week in Psalm 32, have not given their sin to God or haven't allowed him to bring the level of cleansing that we all need. Okay?
I have a question. So, maybe you said this already and I didn't get it, but it says that this is a song that he sang when the Lord delivered him from the hand of all his enemies and from the hand of Saul. So I'm wondering if this isn't before his whole thing with Bathsheba and killing Uriah the Hittite and all that stuff.
Apostle, I don't think we know for sure on that, that the time that was written. And this did end up being a song, one of the psalms that was authorized to be sung in the temple services. So it may have been structured in such that it became a worship psalm for the temple.
I mean, my own experience is that the longer I go on in life, when I've screwed up really bad and really devastated myself by my own sinfulness and my own wretchedness, I can look back on times when I probably would have been praying this way and there would have been a little bit of arrogance in my prayer. And I look back and I go, wow, I was so stupid. And now that I've been through some of this stuff and I've seen how easy it is to fall and get messed up and how much I really need the Lord and his cleansing. So I'm just wondering if some of this might just be a natural human thing, you know.
Yeah.
David always didn't have it together and had it figured out and knew that it was a prophecy for the future or whatever, but he himself was actually caught up in his own, what he thought was his own strength, and then later he felt hard and had to be reminded who God was.
Yeah, I hope Psalm 32 was helpful to you last week to see that. I had thought we might do Psalm 51, which we could, which is still parallel. We'll have to do that. Sue, now let's see, where did I leave off here? 25. With the loyal, thou dost show thyself loyal. With the blameless man, thou dost show thyself blameless. With the pure, thou dost show thyself pure. And with the crooked, thou dost show thyself perverse. I love those two verses. Those are really neat. Now, what's going on there? What is God telling? What are we finding out about God and about us? With the loyal, God shows himself loyal. With the blameless man, he shows himself blameless. Does that mean that God's hypocritical and accommodates himself to your situation? No.
I was going to say, it's almost like today's euphemism, you are what you eat. So it's almost like your relationship with God is what your person certainly, if you're, you know, God's loyal and you're loyal, you're crooked with God, God's crooked with you. It's a relationship.
Yep.
It's how your relationship with God and God's reflecting back on you.
If you're transparent with the Lord and honest and straightforward, he will deal with you that way. And if you want to be deceitful, manipulative, conniving, and you think you can get away with God on that, he'll let some curveballs come in and zap you and throw you off guard. Because his character is, he wants your character to be like his. And there's no nonsense with God. He's holy and he's pure. No fooling around here. Thou dost deliver a humble people, but the haughty eyes thou dost bring down. Yea, thou dost light my lamp. The Lord my God lightens my darkness. Yea, by thee I can crush a troop, and by my God I can leap over a wall. Something about his military prowess against large numbers of Philistines and so on. This God, his way is perfect. The promise of the Lord proves true. He is a shield for all those who take refuge in him. A lifetime of experience with dealing with God. And who is God but the Lord? And who is God but Yahweh? Who is a rock except our God? The God who girded me with strength and made my way safe. He made my feet like hinds' feet and set me secure on the heights. He trains my hands for war, so that my arms can bend a bow of bronze. Thou hast given me the spirit, the shield of thy salvation, and thy right hand supported me, and thy help made me great. Thou didst give a wide place for my steps under me, and my feet did not slip. I pursued my enemies and overtook them, and did not turn back until they were consumed. I thrust them through so that they were not able to rise. They fell under my feet. For thou dost gird me with strength for the battle. Thou didst make my assailants sink under me. Thou didst make my enemies turn their backs to me, and those who hated me I destroyed. They cried for help, but there was none to save. They cried to God, but he did not answer them. I beat them fine as dust before the wind. I cast them out like the mire of the streets. Remember how God likes to fight his battles with a minimum number of troops against impossible odds and give his men like David victory when he's greatly outnumbered. Thou didst deliver me from strife with the peoples. Thou didst make me the head of the nations. People whom I had not known served me. As soon as they had heard of me, they obeyed me. Foreigners came cringing to me. Foreigners lost heart and came trembling out of their fastnesses. What's that about? Talking about his military victories with the surrounding nations during his lifetime? Anything more than that in there? Does it go beyond that? Yeah.
To the Lord, right?
That's the Messiah. This is the Messiah speaking, who eventually... Yeah, go ahead.
I think it reminds me of Psalm 2 then, right? I mean, that sort of ties back to the nations worship the Son and give homage to him.
Mm-hmm. So you've got foreign, alien peoples who know nothing about the God of Israel or the ways of God's people, who are subdued by the Messiah and brought into harmony with the true and living God. That's going to happen on earth soon. And it's Jesus who's going to do it, and the movement that brings this about comes out of Jerusalem, comes out of the city of God with the descendant of David, Jesus, leading the armies of the Lord, right? So the Psalms have these wonderful little nuggets that look right ahead to the Messiah. Foreigners lost heart and came trembling out of their fastnesses. The image of big, powerful enemies that think they're so great. The Lord lives, and blessed be my rock, and exalted be the God of my salvation. Isn't that a hymn or a chorus that we sing? I think it is. The God who gave me vengeance and subdued peoples under me, who delivered me from my enemies. Yea, thou didst exalt me above my adversaries. Thou didst deliver me from men of violence. That's David. That's also the Messiah, talking about his life. For this I extol thee, O Lord, among the nations, and sing praises to thy name. Great triumphs he gives to his king, and shows steadfast love to his anointed, to David and his descendants forever. That last verse is quoted in Romans 15:9 as a quote referring to Jesus. So there's another messianic reference just that leaps out of this particular psalm. Okay, now that's a long psalm. That's 50 long verses. John could do that in about 4 days straight, thoroughly. And I've done it with one sweeping glance, because I hope now that some of you would talk about how this fits into your life or into experience, what you like about this psalm, how it speaks to you, how it fits into your life.
This psalm has been very meaningful to me, and there's especially two things that have stood out for me over the years. And one of them is the thing about how he makes a broad place for us. And you were saying that, you know, we go through hard times and then we come out the other end and we're in this broad place. But I specifically remember a time when I never did come out the other side of it, but in the midst of it, he gave me a broad place. And so that is very powerful to me. I was a missionary in Japan, and the trains there, when you have to take the train every day, all day long, you're just inundated by this mass of people around you, and the men on the trains are not very kind. And sometimes it's very unpleasant experiences when you're on the train, you're surrounded by people, you can't move, you can't see whose hand is where. And I had to ride these trains every day, about 3 hours a day. And for 6 months I was there, I just thought I was going to go insane. And then I was reading this passage, and this concept comes up many other places in Scripture. One of them is in Job, where it talks about he delivered me from the jaws of distress, he laid a table before me. And in Psalm 23, he lays the table before me in the presence of my enemies. And a lot of these pictures of this broad place. But this was the psalm that God brought to my mind one of those days, and began to make that place a place of meditation for me, where I could really find my space in God and not have to find my space in a physical sense. So when I remember that, that's like one of the signposts for me. And one of the other ones is where it talks about, you stoop down to make me great. And our God is the only God who stoops down, who's willing to lower himself to lift us up and to help us. Every other God says, you come up here and make yourself good and get good enough for me. But our God is willing to stoop down to bring us consolation.
Isn't that great? Particularly the imagery of the God of the highest heavens in the temple. You'd think he had other things that were more important in the highest place, but no, it's taking care of one of his servants.
Well, I've got the microphone. I was thinking about Paul's reference to Genesis 11 and the people building the Tower of Babel with those stone, with the bricks that they were making, and then later on the Israelites go into Egypt and they're making bricks, and then they don't even use straw for the bricks. So for them to be constantly speaking of God as their rock, and they don't have to make any bricks, either in futility or for some Pharaoh. I mean, it's like the whole contrast between having the rock be your foundation instead of any bricks you've either made yourself or been forced to make. I think that would be a nice image for them. I mean, for us too. A reminder.
Well, as I had said earlier, having just been in Yosemite, the verse that strikes me is that you enlarge my steps under me and my feet have not slipped. And when you're there, you're struck that without those nice wide steps, you wouldn't see these fantastic views and vistas, and you wouldn't enjoy just this vast part of the park, because you could never do it unless those steps have been built for you. And that's what he does for us, to see life in ways we could never ever see if he hadn't done that for us. And he keeps us from slipping. And I think that strikes me.
Yeah, this is a history that's being written about somebody's life they're not aware of. There's a history of your life that's being recorded that has the grandness that this has. And it's going in a book. Notice that how the poetry of the Psalms is an entirely different teaching style, and the Hebrew teaches entirely different than New Testament Greek, which we are more familiar with. The beauty of the language and the imagery it's so powerful just in the imagery.
I like verse 21 and 23 in this discussion. Where I've kept the ways of the Lord, I've not done evil by turning from my God. Verse 23, I've been blameless before him, and I've kept myself from sin. Reading this, it seems, my first impression is, boy, he's open to conflict and a little cocky, saying that he's been blameless. But David, in a general sense, has been described as a man after God's own heart, and as a godly man. And when you made big mistakes of sin, he confessed them. And that's why he can be called blameless.
Excellent.
It's sort of a prayer and hope in my life that that I can be this confident, and my life can reflect that. That if there are sins in my life, I can confess that and have that homogeneous relationship with God, and the times of tension are very much minimized.
I can certainly identify with that very keenly. That's great. Your day-to-day integrity matters, not just your one-time confession of faith. How you deliberately make choices thoughtfully, carefully, day after day, week after week, the integrity you have at the office, the fidelity you have in your marriage, the honesty you have, the transparency you have, those are all making you into the person that's called righteous in the long run. Righteousness goes to the core of your being, and it's a gift, but you have to work it all out. And David, it's very interesting that this man would be the man after God's own heart. It's some pretty bad blunders, killing Uriah and adultery with Uriah's wife, and not only Uriah, some of his other good soldiers died. All the wives that he had that he didn't love very effectively, and terrible relationships with his sons, really lousy dad most of the time, because his father wasn't all that great to some extent, but some pretty blood. Right at the end of his life, he took a census of the people against the advice of his general. He just wanted to be able to boast in the size of his army. And what happened then? Was God unhappy with that? Very. Cost him the lives of thousands of his soldiers as punishment. And so David's got the blood of those people on his hands too, right at the end of his life.
I'm wanting to think that at the end of his life, David didn't forget what he'd written that we call Psalm 18. Because there's solid stuff there in different ones that have spoken to that. That beginning note of it that's italicized in a lot of Bibles or set up is probably not in the original Hebrew text, but it's consistently translated and included in our versions in there. But even if we take it at face value and say the things that, you know, the census and Bathsheba and all that hadn't yet happened, David did keep short accounts as early in his life, and he did respond when God sometimes put him in a corner, like with Nathan. Mm-hmm. But as was mentioned, he could be cocky early on, and that's the way he was with his brothers.
Yeah,
with the whole scenario with Goliath.
Yeah.
He was a little cocky, it seems to me.
Yeah.
And yet, I think he learned that, I really need to keep close to the Lord. And when he had opportunities, like with the couple situations with Saul, where he could have killed him, and was encouraged to kill him, he didn't do it. And whatever else may have gone on in his mind and considerations, we don't know, except we know he was resolute not to touch the Lord's anointed, as he expressed it on those occasions. So he does seem to be a good example of keeping short accounts with the Lord, and not professing perfection, but responsiveness.
The overall history of Israel, God's unhappiness with Israel is about their hypocrisy, their phoniness, their lack of real day-to-day connection with God. God's a person. We serve a personal God, three of them, in fact. Personal means intimate. It means real. It means honest. It means open. It means up-to-date. And so much of our Christianity today is cultural. I think it's just to switch on the autopilot and let's go. We don't leave time in our lives for the meditation or the quiet self-examination or the review with a friend like Jesus that would review the events of the day and show us correction. I'm amazed at how much correction I need now at this late in life. It's scary a little bit. But God's utterly faithful and loving and ready to forgive. And hypocrisy is our big enemy then, being phony, pretending to be something you're not. If you're intimate with God, if you're intimate and open with God, then intimacy with other people follows easily. You can have intimate friendships. I notice so many lonely people in the world today who have no close friendships, so many hollow marriages where there's no real communication between family members. And that's the intimacy is gone in the community, and it's gone with God. And the country is aware of the fact that Christians are just drifting along without any contact with a real living being who does come down and shake the heavens. I don't want to rant here.
Lambert, I think that the sweep of his life, as you've just been talking about, and that scene with Goliath, I mean, to David, it is unthinkable that somebody would speak like that about God. I mean, it's just absolutely intolerable, and everybody else is shaking in their boots. And David is saying, "This, our God is magnificent, holy, and all this other stuff. You know, who is this uncircumcised Philistine? You know, I'm taking him out now." and not in a boastful sense, but just like, it cannot be tolerated that our God has spoken it that way. And he goes after him. And obviously, as we know, he succeeds with that. And I see that as being part of David being a man after God's own heart.
Yeah.
After he matures, after his big sins, when life is easier, and all that kind of stuff, gets to the end of his life, and he's talking to Solomon shortly before he dies, And it's almost, my short version is, Solomon, I've made some really big mistakes, and you know that. And I wanted to build God a temple, and God told me no and gave me the reasons, and he reminded Solomon of what those were. But Solomon, you do it. And I think there's the other end of his life where he's still got a heart for God. Even though he's gone through those rocky places, he's returned to the Lord and seen God's restoration and affirmation.
Good.
Yeah, Leonard, I was focusing on verse 39 where it says we have greater need of strength for battle. It seems like a warrior like him would be particularly attuned to the opposite of that, which would be sickness. And there was a time, I can't remember exactly the example, where he was really sick. And a verse, Psalm 38 speaks to that. And then how he was laid low. I think there's a pattern there where he comes to grips with his own sinfulness. But he also comes to grips with the futility of trying to strike back and even the wrongs that were being perpetrated against him and the nation. I'm reminded of that little phrase, belligerent self-pity, which came up in the confessions of an ex-terrorist from Egypt who said, you know, we boil it all down, that's what motivated me before I got out of the mafia or whatever they call themselves over there. And David understands that his strength comes from the Lord, and that even his righteousness is an imputed righteousness of sorts, that he didn't just grow up that way. He had it given to him by the Lord. And it's sort of a mystery to me what the mechanism was back before Christ. But as John's already mentioned, and Steve, there was a repentance there somewhere, and a humbling where he realized the source of his strength was in himself.
Great. Anybody have any favorite psalms that I should put on the to-do list? And this was supposed to start out with some of the royal psalms, first of all, and it's been a little helter-skelter. Send me an email if you have a psalm that you're burning to share with us, too.
Because
oh, any psalm, yeah.
Psalm
73. 73?
No, you
said. Oh, the Asaph psalms.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, Asaph came up a few weeks ago, didn't it?
And it just speaks to me of like the way the world is today and how complicated it seems, because of the kind of milieu that I hang out in, I'm around a lot of unbelievers all the time, and they're not only, they're doing just fine, and they're also wonderful, kind, generous, happy people. And so I really understand Asaph's deal there. You know, like, what's going on here?
That's a great psalm. Thank you. I did look up Asaph. There are 13 psalms by Asaph. 73 to 80, whatever. It's thought that he was one of the choir leaders in the time of David. However, there's a couple of these psalms that just historically don't fit that time period. So it's a little mystery about, is there just one Asaph, or maybe later on one of his sons? They're really, if you read through all the Psalms of Asaph, there's some commonality. You can see this guy is familiar with the temple services. Yeah, that makes it, let's do that. Psalm 73, God willing, should the Lord tarry. Okay, have we done enough today to get everybody sleepy? Or any more comments?
Thanks, Lambert. Again, it's great to have you back with us. And I remind folks periodically because the means to support Lambert has changed in the last year. And if you're led by the Lord to support Lambert, that's done through Ray Steadman Ministries. And so I just remind folks again, just in case that's what God's called you as far as how you might share. So great that you're vertical today, as we like to say. And Cynthia's just going to lead us in a couple well-known choruses this morning. I think we'll do Is How Great Thou Art, okay, the first verse, and then maybe Amazing Grace to close, if that's okay.
I will call upon the Lord, I'm coming up.
Oh, okay. Well, if you want to come.
That's a chorus. I don't usually do choruses. Okay,
let's do How Great Thou Art.
Oh Lord my God, when I in awesome wonder consider all the worlds thy hands have made, I see the stars, I hear the rolling thunder, thy heart throughout the universe's sway. Then sings my soul, my Savior God, to thee. How great thou art, how great thou art. Then sings my soul, my Savior God, to thee. How great thou art.